For any lie to be successful, it needs to be partially true, or at least based in part on truth. The Corinthians, in Paul's day, took statements from the Stoics and even statements from Paul himself and contaminated them by coming to conclusions which they were never meant to produce. You can see that in your notes there, the Corinthians' mindset, the first chart. They believed, based on, you'll see in verse 12, they believed that all things are lawful for me. And Paul has articulated that too. But they concluded, therefore, since all things are lawful for me, I'm free to participate in any activity. Secondly, all things are lawful for me, therefore I'm enslaved to nothing or no one. I'm my own master. Thirdly, they believe that food's for the stomach and the stomach for foods, but God will destroy both it and them, both the food and the stomach. So they concluded, what I do in my physical body is disconnected from my spiritual maturity. And this was very characteristic of the culture that they grew up in, that was all throughout the city of Corinth. The Stoic philosophy of dualism. In other words, they separated spirit from matter. Matter is all wicked and spirit is all good. And so what they concluded from that is that with my spirit, I'm going to serve God. You know, I'm going to be spiritual. But then with my body, it really doesn't matter what I do because ultimately, like food and the stomach, it's all going to be destroyed anyway. So it really doesn't matter what activity you participate in. So you get this dualistic lifestyle where with the spirit, they're singing, they're teaching, they're praying. And then with the body, they're, you know, living in sexual immorality, partying, whatever. So from that philosophy, you have people who can come to church on Sunday morning, claiming to be a Christian, worshiping with all the other people, and yet on Friday night, you know, get drunk and sleep around and all the kind of things that don't characterize a believer. Now you think, how can that kind of lifestyle occur without a Christian knowing that it's wrong or being convicted or changing? And this is what Paul writes for. He says these two things are incompatible. He's going to give us three reasons why a Christian cannot live a lifestyle of sexual immorality. And he's going to, first of all, establish that the number one reason is simply the resurrection. Now, you're going to notice as we go through these reasons, they're very different than the reasons we would typically give for abstinence or purity. Paul is once again, as we've seen throughout this whole book, looking at this from a God-centered perspective, not a man-centered perspective. So he said the first reason Christians don't live a lifestyle of sexual immorality is the resurrection. My body has a future. What does that mean? Look at verse 13. This is where we pick up from last week. Food's for the stomach and the stomach for foods. But God will destroy both it and them. Now the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord. And the Lord for the body. And God both raised up the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. You'll see a little chart in your notes contrasting the Corinthian view of the body with the Christian view of the body. Corinthian mindset was just as the belly was made for food and both will be destroyed, so the body was made for lust and both are irrelevant. You follow that line of reasoning? They said that just as you eat a burger in the next week, it really doesn't matter what you ate, and ultimately that burger and your body, your stomach, are going to be decayed or destroyed. so it was just a natural thing for your stomach to consume food. It is a natural thing for your body, which has a built-in lust mechanism, to participate in sexual activity. And so there can't be anything wrong with that. And that the Christian mindset is very different. Paul will give them that statement. Just as the belly was made for food and both will be destroyed. Okay, yeah. What you consume today is going to be gone tomorrow. And yeah, your stomach was made for food. But you see the shift. He says your body was not made for sexual immorality. The body was made for Christ, and both are going to be raised. Christ has been raised. Your body will be raised. And so, yes, your body may be filled with germs. It may get sick. It may even be beaten. You ultimately may die. But, the end of verse 13, the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. In other words, the Lord has a plan for your body. Your body has a future. Like, what does that mean? And the proof he gives, verse 14, is that God raised up the Lord. He didn't just raise up his spirit. He raised up his body, and he's going to raise up your body. So what kind of impact does that have on our thinking as Christians? Now, he's going to develop the whole resurrection idea in 1 Corinthians 15, a whole chapter about that. So we'll get that then. But the impact on our thinking with regard to purity is huge. Look at the quotation from C.S. Lewis. I know some muddle-headed Christians have talked as if Christianity thought that sex or the body or pleasure were bad in and of themselves. But they were wrong. Christianity is almost the only one of the great religions which thoroughly approves of the body, which believes that matter is good, that God himself once took on a human body, that some kind of body is going to be given to us even in heaven. Christianity has glorified marriage more than any other religion. And nearly all the greatest love poetry in the world has been produced by Christians. If anyone says that sex in itself is bad, Christianity contradicts him at once. So you see what Paul is doing here. It's an amazing line of thinking. When Paul heard that the Corinthians were living lifestyles of sexual immorality, he could have very easily sent a letter and just said, hey guys, stop. All that body stuff is evil. You need to stop living in sexual immorality. But he doesn't. In some ways, he does the opposite. In other words, he not only is negating the perversion, but he's elevating the pure side, the true side. He's saying that the opposite of sexual immorality is not being a prude. It's not ignoring the reality of this whole aspect of our life and of our bodies. It's not ignoring the physical body and devaluing it. Paul is actually valuing it. Do you see what he's doing? He's saying what you do in your body is important. Your body is important. You are spirit and body. And you can't disconnect those two. You can't say this is a part of me that's body and this is a part of me that's spirit. That God has a plan for both. He's going to raise up both. So whatever you do to counter the perverted side of sex, you don't do it by devaluing. You do it by focusing on what is true. So number one, my body has a future. But number two, says my body has a member, is a member. My body is a member. What does that mean? Look at verse 15. He goes on, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. May it never be. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh, but he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him? In a recent survey, when people were asked, you'll see it there in your notes, a man and a woman who live together without being married are A, violating a biblical principle, a basic principle of human morality, B, living in a way that could be destructive to society, C, doing their own thing and not affecting anyone else, D, experimenting with a worthwhile alternative lifestyle, E, none of the above. Do you see the one that most Americans automatically chose? That for a couple to live together, participate in sexual immorality without being married, they are not affecting anyone else. In other words, this is just an issue between two consenting adults. It's none of anybody else's business. It doesn't hurt anybody. It doesn't affect anybody else. And if you add together the experimenting with a worthwhile alternative lifestyle, you've got 75% of Americans think that there's nothing negative about that activity. And what God is saying is the opposite. He is saying that there is a lot more going on there than what meets the eye. That this is not just a lifestyle choice. That this is, especially when we're talking about, obviously when we're talking about believers, that this is not just between the two of them. That there's at least a third party involved here. You see that in verse 15? Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? I mean, anytime someone participates in this activity with anyone who is not their spouse, they are connecting Christ to that activity and defiling that union. Lewis writes, the monstrosity of sexual intercourse outside marriage is that those who indulge in it are trying to isolate one kind of union, the sexual, from all the other kinds of union, which were intended to go along with it and make up the total union. Do you follow that? In other words, the way God planned it, which is a beautiful thing, is that the sexual union, the physical part, would only be one component along with the psychological part, the emotional part, the spiritual part. You could even say the chronological part. In other words, there's a time element, a commitment element. There's a whole set of other elements that make up this package of the physical, psychological, emotional, relational, spiritual relationship. And Christ is a part of that. Christ is an intricate part of that union. Ephesians 5 magnifies that. But when a believer participates in this activity with anyone who is not his spouse, what they're doing is they're dragging Christ into this unholy union. They're defiling him. They're pretending like the sex act is independent from all these other relational issues. And this is why I believe it is so sad what our culture is doing to young people. Just one of the reasons. They're telling young people that you can participate in this activity regardless of any of these other areas being involved, in any of these other relationships. And we're stealing, we're deceiving our young people. Listen to what one 16-year-old was quoted even this past week in Newsweek magazine. He talked about the time he lost his virginity, and he lamented the fact that he felt deceived. It was not what he was told it would be. He said, in movies, if people have sex, it's always romantic. And he admitted, he said, physically, yes, it did feel good, but it felt, emotionally, he says, it felt really awkward. It was not what I expected it to be. Why? Our culture would say, well, you just got to get over those hang-ups, moral hang-ups. And God would say, no, no, no. What you're doing is you're ignoring the connection here. There is a connection going on here. That there are all these levels of relationship, that physical part is only supposed to be one part of the component. And if you ignore all the other areas, it's no wonder it's so empty and people have to keep going on to weirder and weirder stuff. Because they don't understand the package. The package is beautiful when it comes as a package. When it comes independent of that, we're deceiving people. We're lying to them. God never meant for that to go on independent of these other relationships. See, in verse 16, he says, do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? That word joined is cleave. He who cleaves or unite. This word is used in the Greek. It's used of gluing. There's this super bond that occurs. So the idea of a one-night stand or a quick relationship that's purely physical is not known in the Bible. There's no such thing. There is a bond that goes on there. That if you ignore it, you ignore it to your own detriment. And a believer cannot ignore that. Because he's connected to Christ. She's connected to Christ. And so when you ignore that, you're bringing in Christ in this unholy union. As Hayes writes, it is crucial to recognize that he does not treat fornication as belonging to the sphere of private morality. This is not about you deciding what your personal convictions are. Although you need to come to a conviction, obviously. But this isn't a Romans 14 issue. This isn't some people do that and other people don't. You know, some Christians have decided to live pure and other Christians have decided not to. He says this isn't about private morality. It damages the community as a whole. And it can be corrected only if the Corinthians come to understand their bodies as members of Christ. See, I believe this is the only way Christians are really going to be able to live pure in a culture like ours. Because I'll tell you what, you can have an accountability partner and you need one of those. You can have accountability and you can have somebody looking over your shoulders, or if you're a teenager, you can have parents that have strict rules. But the bottom line is, in our culture, you can get away with it if you want it better. I mean, it's everywhere. So ultimately, a believer has to be aware of the fact that this isn't just about me. And this isn't just about somebody knowing about what I'm doing. This is about the fact that if nobody else knows what I'm doing, I am connected to Christ and He is with me in this activity. Which is sobering. Paul is saying, Corinthians, this is not about your culture, even though their culture approved of this kind of activity. It was not only legal, prostitution was not only legal, but it was normal. It was acceptable. Everybody did it. And Paul is saying, as a believer, you're part of a community. Do you see how he keeps going back to that? With lawsuits at the beginning of the chapter, he says, guys, you're part of a community. Why would you go outside of the community to sue a brother within the community? Here, he does the same thing. How can you defile the community? You're connected to Christ, and Christ is connected to all these other believers. And so you're not just affecting yourself. You're contaminating the whole community. So my body is a member. Therefore, verse 18, flee sexual immorality. Flee. It's in the present tense, which is an encouragement, should be to us. It is to me that this is not just going to be a one-time flee. You're not just going to run once. This is going to have to be a habit, a continual habit, because every time you look, everywhere you look, it's going to be coming at you, and you have to run the other way like Joseph. Who lived in a culture where it was perfectly acceptable. But because he was convinced that this was a sin not just against somebody else, but against God. He ran. And we have to run hard and run often. There's a good possibility in this next phrase that Paul is once again quoting the Corinthians. It could go either way. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. That first phrase, every sin that a man does is outside the body. That's very consistent with what the Corinthians believed. Remember the gap between the spirit and the body. That sin really doesn't affect your body is what they were saying. So it's outside of the body, so it really doesn't matter what lifestyle decisions you make as far as how you use your body. The key is just having that spirit right, which means, you know, going to church and thinking happy thoughts about God or whatever, but that they totally disconnected that from what you do with your body. And Paul says, no. This sin, he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. You are not just sinning against God, but you are sinning against your body. What does that mean? How does sexual immorality sin against our bodies? There's a couple possibilities, and probably he's referring to a couple of things here. One possibility is he could be referring to venereal disease. You're actually literally physically defiling your body. Fee points out in the introduction of his commentary discussing the city of Corinth that even today you can go to a museum and there is a whole room full of these clay votives that actually have human organs used for this activity all over them that are being offered to gods, the gods of healing. In other words, in this culture, venereal disease so ravaged the people that they would actually have gods of healing where they would offer prayers and offerings for healing of that area. It's no different than today. It's amazing. After decades of Planned Parenthood, sexual education, the United States is still number one in industrial nations for STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. Number one. That every year there are 15 million new cases where the highest rate, 50% of these 15 million new cases every year are incurable. 65 million people in the United States, 65 million people have STDs, sexually transmitted disease. HPV is the most common with 20 million people. And most of these diseases are not going to kill somebody, or many of them are not going to kill you. But many of them cause other diseases that can kill you. For example, HPV, which is the most common, was present in 99.7% of cervical cancer cases. So the impact, we don't even know the impact of all these diseases in affecting other things. And so when Paul says that when you participate in this activity, you are literally sinning against your own body, he could be referring to that. It was common in his culture, it's common in our culture. Or he could be simply saying that when we commit sexual immorality, we are not simply participating in a physical act that can destroy the body physically, but we are using our body as a link between Christ and the person we're sinning with. So the body, which was made to glorify God, as we're going to see in a minute, we're sinning against it because we're using it as a tool in an unholy union. And his point would be, that's not what I made your body for. And that leads him to his third point, where he drives this home, that my body not only has a future, my body is not only a member connected to Christ, but thirdly, my body has an owner. Do you not know, verse 19, that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own, for you are bought at a price. Pro-abortionists, activists have been brainwashing our young people for decades, saying it's your body, it's your decision. So if you decide to sleep with your boyfriend or kill your baby, that's just your decision. It's just your body. It's simply a private, amoral decision. Listen to Faye Waddleton of Planned Parenthood as she describes the organization's mission. The answer to teen pregnancy lies not in preaching the return to a morality of an earlier time, but in making teens have access to sex education and contraceptives. Well, all the statistics now prove that as sex education of their kind, as that increases, sexual activity also increases. We are not going to be an organization promoting celibacy or chastity. That's obvious. Listen to this. Our concern is not to convey shoulds and should nots. Well, amen. But to help young people make responsible decisions about their sexual relationships. What are responsible decisions? Listen, she's going to tell us what that is. We've got to be more concerned about preventing teen pregnancies than we are about stopping sexual relationships. So try to understand that logic. We're not going to be an organization about shoulds and should nots, but you should have sex, but you should not have babies. See, they're doing the same thing. They're preaching shoulds and should nots. They're preaching a morality, but it's their own morality. Not God's morality. They're trying to disconnect that physical act from any other relationship. You don't need a husband. You don't need a wife. You don't need kids. You don't need love. You don't need commitment. All you need to be is two dogs in heat, and you can do this. And he is saying, no. No, no, no. You are bought with a price. You are paid for. Now, obviously, for this kind of mindset to stand, you've got to get God out of the picture. That's why Planned Parenthood has got to eliminate God. That's why they're constantly attacking religion, because religion is their greatest enemy. Because it's amazing, the teens that are interviewed even today, the ones who have remained virgins, the number one reason they have is religion. Many of them Christians. Even Newsweek this past week, there was an article. I don't know if any of you saw that. It was actually encouraging in many ways. The New Virginity was the title. And that in the last couple years, the percentage of teens who are participating in sex before marriage has actually declined for the first time in a long time. It's gone down 10%. We're still way up there. Pitifully high. But it's actually gone down. Why? Because the first time our government is actually funding abstinent programs, something we Christians have been screaming about for decades, for the first time it's starting to happen. And it's starting to have an impact. But the teens who are saying why they're doing this, the number one reason is because they believe God says it's wrong. And there's something bigger than just them. In contradiction to the teenager's Bill of Rights. Have you ever read that? I have the right to think for myself. I have the right to decide whether to have sex or who to have it with. I have the right to use protection when I have sex. I have the right to express myself. This is the teenager's Bill of Rights. Does that not sound just like the Corinthians? All things are lawful for me. We haven't changed much, have we? This is not a new thing we're going through. And so the words of Paul still remain true today, after 2,000 years. Christians are going to think different. Look at, he makes three simple points here. Number one, you are the Spirit's dwelling place. You are the Spirit's dwelling place. Your body is God's house. Like we learned in chapter 3, verse 16, the church as a whole is God's temple. And now he's even bringing it down smaller than that. You, as a believer, are God's temple. Now, most of us, because we're not into temples, you know, we really don't know this, the significance of that. But look back just real quick at Exodus chapter 40. This is right after they had finished the tabernacle, which was to be God's dwelling place, a representation of God's presence. And in verse 34 of Exodus 40, "Then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting because the cloud rested above it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." Whew. Can you imagine being there? I mean, Moses, the man who had gone up to the mountain to receive the tablets. I mean, Moses, this was not brand new to him, but even Moses could not enter the tabernacle for the awesome presence of God. And what God is saying is, as magnificent as that tabernacle was, and as much splendor as the temple in Israel had, I want to tell you something. Where is that temple now? It's right there, in you. You talk about sobering, about thinking about what you put into your body and what you practice with your body. Paul is not devaluing the body. He's magnifying the body from God's perspective, not man's. You're not your own. You are the Spirit's dwelling place. And remember this, folks. This is not a threat. He is not saying to you, if you don't clean up your act, I'm not going to come in you. Look at the way he wrote it. He said, this is a promise. This isn't a threat. I'm in you. If you're a believer, I'm in you. Now live as if that's so. Stop ignoring that. I'm in you, not because you were pure, but because of my son. Now live that out in the decisions you make. If you're waiting to get pure enough to have the Spirit come in you, you're going to die without knowing the Spirit. But as you call out to him, he comes in you and he begins that cleaning up process. And messages like this and passages like this are part of that process. He uses his word to cleanse us, to change our thinking, and to counter what we're being bombarded with all week long from our culture and from our cravings. He's saying, I want you to be a temple, a holy temple. Secondly, he says, you are not your own. You're not an independent agent. This isn't just about you and your girlfriend or you and your boyfriend or you and your fiance deciding what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. If you are a believer, you are not your own master. You are not your own. Thirdly, you were bought at a price. You were bought at a price. And the word there is in the aorist tense, which means it's a definitive action. He's talking about Christ's work on the cross. Christ shed his holy, infinitely valuable blood to pay for your body. And so for you to take that body that he paid for and go out and use it in a way that it was never intended to be used, you're defrauding God. It would be like going over your friend's house who just got a brand new BMW. He saved up for 10 years so he could pay cash for this thing. It's absolutely stunning. He calls you up and tells you he finally got it, and you were sick of hearing about it. For 10 years he was saving all his pennies and putting this money away, and he finally bought this thing. You go over and look at it and you say, wow, that is gorgeous. And look at those treads on those tires. Can I borrow it today? He says, what do you need it for? And he said, well, I've got to go to Home Depot. I've got to pick up 20 bags of cement. I've got to run over to my lot where I'm building a house and because my car can't make it through the mud. And I need to be able to pull up to these footers that I'm pouring and drop these bags of cement all around these footers, and I'll have it back to you by this evening. You know, what is he going to say to you? listen, pal, I didn't buy that car for that. I didn't buy it to haul cement. I didn't pay the kind of money I paid for that car so you could run through the mud with it. That's what God is saying to us. I paid for your body. I bought it at the price of my son. No, don't use it for a purpose that it was never intended to be used for. The world is lying to you when it says that's the purpose of a body. It's not the purpose. Ask the owner. Check in with the Creator. He knows how it works. It's amazing how we are taught the opposite. Just recently, the Family Research Council produced a pretty amazing compilation of data and statistics and public opinion called The Family Portrait, a whole book analyzing where the family is today. Everything from cohabitation to adult unwed childbearing to teenage sexuality, it's all in there. And what they do is they compile it from a whole bunch of different organizations, so it's not just Christians getting this information. And it's amazing to me just to see the physical, scientific, empirical, unquestionable evidence that we have in our culture that God's way works. I mean, even if you don't even believe the Bible, there is obvious facts and information that prove God has made our bodies in a specific way, and there's only one way that really works in a culture. And yet we're rejecting. I could give you hundreds of examples, but just one. Cohabitation. A man and a woman living together without being married. You think, what possibly could be wrong with that? As long as they love each other, and they're committed to each other, and they intend to do good in the future, what could be wrong with that? Listen to the evidence. Couples who live together before marriage are almost twice as likely to divorce as couples who do not live together. Couples that live together have a greater chance of being depressed, have described themselves as less happy, less committed, having poorer relationships than married couples. They're 3 times more likely to experience physical aggression, 3 times more likely to have alcohol problems, 6 times more likely for their kids to have behavioral problems. The list goes on and on. They have poorer communication, greater infidelity. You think, but that type of lifestyle choice has exploded in our culture. In other words, having the benefits of marriage without the commitment. And God says it doesn't work. That's not why I made your bodies. But our culture is saying the opposite. Once again, a teenager said, this is a teenager. Look at everything. TV, movies, the culture today makes it seem okay to have sex whenever, however, and with whomever you want. I disagree with that. So in other words, our culture is sending a loud message, and I know I don't need to convince you of that. It's a loud message saying that your body is your body and you can use it any way you want. And God is saying the opposite. Look at his conclusion. Therefore, verse 20. Glorify God where? In your body. There's textual question as to whether that last phrase is in there. Some of your texts will have it, some of you will not. Because Paul is specifically, most of the best manuscripts don't have it. But either way, Paul is not denying the fact that you glorify God in your spirit. But the Corinthians had no problem with that, right? They thought, okay, you come together on Sunday and you worship God with your spirit, and we're all over that. But they disconnected that from what they did with their bodies on Friday night. And he's saying, no, 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 no. Remember when we started Corinthians, and I say it over and over again, what Corinthians will do is force the gospel onto our daily lives to see whether we're living it, not just talking about it. Once again, he does that. Glorify God. Worship God where? In your body. In your body. Because the body is the physical expression, the visible expression of the Lordship of Christ. So rather than disconnecting worship from your body, live out worship in your body. You know something? The world does that. The world does that. They worship their God with their bodies. Well, who is their God? Listen to the editor of Spin magazine as he worships his God. Sex is an instinct, timeless, immortal, indiminishable, and apolitical. It is the most powerful force known in the universe. It is also the very source of all human life. The reason we are here hurling ourselves vainly against its infinite power. You see the words he used? Those are God words, folks. Infinite power, instinct, timeless, immortal, most powerful force known in the universe. Our culture is simply worshiping the God of sex. And Christians need to scream out, we will not bow to the God of sex. That is, our hormones are not the most powerful force in the universe. Hello? That's why he's saying, you've got to connect your worship on Sunday with the way you live. That's what this is all about. This isn't a political issue. He rightly admits that. This isn't about being a fanatical right-wing conservative or a tree-hugging lefter. This is not about politics. It's not just about culture. It's about religion. It's all about who you worship. Do you worship your body? Do you worship the message that the culture and the movies and the media are trying to thrust on our people? Or do we believe God is the most powerful force in the universe? Now I'm telling you, our culture and our cravings will scream the opposite. They will scream the opposite 24 hours a day. What Paul is saying is no. No, 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 no. And he puts a little extra Greek word in there that you don't see in the English that magnifies the intensity of the imperative. Command. Glorify God. Do it now. Do it so speedily that it's already done. In other words, it's going to take an intensity. You're going to have to be a fanatic, folks. You got to be a fanatic. You can't go halfway with this. You can't say, well, I kind of think God's powerful, but all this other stuff over here sure looks good and is powerful. Saying, no, no, no. Will you glorify God? Is He your God? We're going to need help with that, aren't we? Living in this culture, just like the Corinthians. Imagine them coming out of a lifestyle where prostitution was normal, where fidelity was unthought of. I mean, there are, even in our culture, there are still good moral people who basically think, like even in the most surveys, 75% of Americans believe that a man and a woman who are married should remain faithful to each other. So even in our culture, there's some semblance of once you are married, you should be true to your spouse. Adultery is wrong. But see, in the city of Corinth, that wasn't even there. These poor people, they became believers, and all of a sudden they're reading this? You can imagine the shock. You mean you don't do that outside of marriage? Paul is saying, it's all about worship. Our God is great. He is the most powerful force in the universe. And the fact that He is doesn't devalue the body or sex. But what it does do is put it under His lordship. He knows how it works. And He knows what won't work. And so the questions we have before us now are, will we submit ourselves to His thinking or ours?